you are about to hear are the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
You seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with The Rebel Broker. My name's Robert Whitelaw, and I am The Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, a member of the National Association of Realtors. And yes, you are trapped in here with me until you press stop or pause or turn off your phone or your computer. But until then, you're mine. And I hope you have a great time. We have some interesting stuff to talk about today. As always, well, not as always, because sometimes that doesn't happen, but the chat room is up. If you'd like to participate, head on over to www.therebelbroker.com. Follow the link to the show, or you can just head straight on over to Blog Talk Radio and find me there. And you'll find the show going live, and the chat room is there, and all that other kind of wonderful stuff. If you'd prefer not, and you'd like to call in, you can do that. And the number there is 877-503-5033. 877-503-5033 if you'd like to chat live, ask a question or anything like that. It's been a very, very eventful week for me. As I've kind of been alluding to, I'm doing some stuff in my own real estate world. And I think it's going to be a great opportunity for us to talk a little bit more about moving forward with real estate investing, if it's something you have an interest in, on two different fronts. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag on the second front because I haven't laid those bricks yet, but that it's going to be coming. But right now, I just signed off yesterday on my latest deal. And as you know, I'm a teeny bit superstitious. Less superstitious. I mean, there's less worrying about Universal Mojo screwing with my deal and more just until the money arrives in the account, just don't do anything or say anything that could make someone think something weird. I will talk about some of the most bizarre documents I have ever seen in a sign-off that I had to sign yesterday. We can talk about the sign-off process, which was interesting because this is me buying in another state and I had a mobile signer. And, you know, historically in my business, I have resisted mobile signing notaries. I've never had one go without a hitch. Whenever I know I have to use one for whatever reason, I like to have at least a 5-day buffer. Yeah, so at least we'll talk about that. Because I don't think that screws with anything in terms of the universal balance of karma or business closures or anything like that. So here we go. The very first thing I'm going to share with you is the mobile notary. And for those mobile notaries out there who do a wonderful job and are fantastic at what you do, thank you so much. For the ones I've had to deal with over the last 20 years, and there haven't been that many. After my first one, which was, I think, God, it was really early in my real estate career where I had to deal with a mobile notary, and it completely put me off of doing that if I can avoid it. But sometimes you can't. Sometimes if you're someone selling your home and you've already moved to another state, you know, if you can't for some reason sign in a local title company there where you are, if it's not a national chain, for instance, if it's not Chicago Title, if it's not First, whatever. I can't remember the name of the company I used, First something. Anyway, I can even see their logo in my head, but I can't remember the second word. But anyway, if you can't physically go to a place and sit down and do stuff, but all you have is a mobile notary, it carries with it some built-in limits. Number one, you're dealing with someone who is operating outside of the system, meaning that if it's someone from Chicago Title, there's usually some sort of a system built in for them to cooperate with one another. If you're dealing with a mobile notary, these are folks who have never seen your deal before, who don't get a lot of advance notice, and they just get your documents and they're told to come and have you sign. And why do I say you should build in 5 days? In other words, if they don't need your, if you were to sign the documents and they needed to be in someone's hands within 2 or 3 days, instead of doing it 2 or 3 days before they need it in their hands, do it 8 days before they need it in their hands. Primarily because, and you know, a lot of this has to do with your lender too and your title company. This isn't just the fault of the mobile person. But in my case, they showed up with completely screwed up paperwork. If I had signed the paperwork, well, it wouldn't have worked because it didn't have her signature too. But all of this paperwork, for whatever bizarre reason, included another family member's name who has nothing to do with this transaction at all. The intent of this transaction is to put me exclusively on the title. It's to have me exclusively on the loan. And it had me and this other person on everything. Have no idea how that mistake got made. This other person's name was never even brought up. I'm not even really sure how it got to be mixed in with this transaction, but it was just out of the blue. So my lender had managed to get the documents, put them together incorrectly, supposedly review them, and send them to title, who may or may not have reviewed them, who then sent them to a mobile notary in my area to have me sign. So she and I connect. I'm looking at these documents and I'm seeing all these references to this other person. And I'm like, okay, I guess we're done because I'm not signing any of this with this person's information on it. So, you know, they had to go back and do it again. Luckily, this was Friday. Saturday, we were able to connect again. They sent her the wrong documents again, but to the credit of this mobile notary, she looked for the specific corrections that we were talking about and saw that literally they sent us the exact same documents again. But this time it was just the mobile notary company. The mobile notary company got the updated documents, but sent her the old documents again. So she contacted the office and said, hey, you sent me the exact same documents. And so they discovered they had made a mistake and that all got solved. So we signed off everything yesterday. And this really just brings home how you cannot assume that any of the people in this process know what the hell they're doing or that they are incapable of making profound and dramatic mistakes where if you sign the papers they put in front of you, you can really screw up your life. This is one reason why I like to be present at every single signing when my folks sign off. It isn't because I'm sure everyone else is going to screw up. It's simply because I believe that the more eyes on something this critical, the better. Am I the smartest guy in the room? Maybe, maybe not. Is my client the smartest guy in the room? Maybe, maybe not. Is the title person, is the lender. And the lender is another person I usually like to have in the room, which is one reason why I like working with Tracy Starback, because 99% of the time she's able to do that for me. But that's another story. So you want to absolutely know what these documents are supposed to say before you get them. Now, that was another shortcoming of this particular transaction for me. In my business, when my clients are going to go sign escrow, I want a sample. I want the pack. I want what they're going to sign sent to my clients electronically at least a week ahead of time. I want them to be able to review everything. You can't read every single page, and you can strategically read when you get in there because most of it's forms, most of it's boilerplate with numbers plopped in. You just want to look at those numbers and make sure they're right. But the last thing you want to do is sit there with a calculator at the moment you're supposed to be signing it. That should happen before you sign it. So I'm going to suggest now, because of the way my deal worked out and because of the timetable I was asking for, so it's my fault, they couldn't get me documents a week ahead of time. But I felt comfortable with my ability to look at the documents and know what to expect. I'd already calculated ballpark numbers. I'd already discussed ballpark numbers with my lender and with title. I knew what the fees were, what the what all the different things were. So I knew what numbers to expect to see plugged in, and I knew what to expect in terms of what numbers I should see at the bottom. And I knew what different elements there were. There was one form I had not seen or heard about, completely freaked me out. Well, didn't completely freak me out, but completely threw me for a loop. Well, you know, if maybe when we take a break, I'll go grab the packet and I'll just read this form to you. It's not very long. It's just a one page deal, but I've never seen it before. In anything ever in 20, good Lord, are we at 25 years now? I think we're nearly 25 years of me doing this. Over 25 years. Jeez. I'm getting old. Anyway, never seen it before. And if I ever did expect to see this form, I would have expected it with some of the information filled in that they seem to expect me to fill in. So we'll either talk about it today, or maybe I'll take a break at some point and I'll go get it and then we can talk about the form, or maybe I'll wait till next time. I have a feeling the next show I do will be almost exclusively dedicated to the process of acquiring this investment property or this second home property. It's supposed to close on Thursday, so we'll see if the money appears on Thursday. I might do a show Thursday night. If the money doesn't appear till Friday, maybe it'll be Friday or Saturday. But in any event, as soon as everything is done and it's a done deal and everything's cool, then I am going to try to share with you all the insights I can, so that not just because I want to tell you the story, but because I want you to see a path within what I've done on how you can move forward with your own investment. Now, I've had some people say they think the time has passed for a lot of things like this. And I think that if you want to look at where the market is today versus where it was several years ago, it's really hard to argue with that. You know, I still look back at opportunities I came across in 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, all of these times where I came across a property. I said, you know, if I bought this house, this would be a ridiculous moneymaker. And these were a lot of the foreclosure properties, a lot of the short sale properties, properties I ended up selling to clients. There's two homes that I ended up selling to clients that I kick myself for not purchasing. They were in areas where you would absolutely want to live if you live in Morgan Hill. They had access to the best elementary school in town. They were in nice neighborhoods. They were ridiculously well priced and now are selling for nearly twice what they were selling for in 2008, 2009, 2010. So, and what's worse is my instincts, there's nothing worse than having an instinct about something and sort of just going, well, you know, I'll stay on the path I'm on. I'll keep doing what I'm doing. And sort of just blowing that idea off or for whatever reason, deciding to not do it. But in your mind, think this property is one that could blow the socks off. And looking at it today, I'm proven absolutely correct, but not in a great way, not in a, wow, I'm glad I took my own advice way, but in a damn, I really missed the boat way. So I absolutely wasn't going to let that happen again with this particular property that we're going to be talking about as soon as it closes. And we'll see how it goes, because this is going to be a very interesting experience. I've never really dealt with a property in the way that I'm going to be dealing with this property before. It's really going to be intended. I mean, one of the main goals is for me to have a great place that I can go. For me personally, but also a great property that I can use to build wealth, to have a property that works for me in a way I've never made a property work for me before. I mean, I've done different types of deals in the past, but this is a total departure for me. So in a lot of ways, the experience I'll be able to share with you is as close to absolute newbie type getting familiar with it stuff as I can, with the proviso obviously being that I've been doing mainstream real estate for a very, very long time. So I have the benefit of that experience. But as many people have told me, this is completely different. So it's gonna be a whole different kind of thing. I'm very excited about it, frankly. I'm kind of jazzed about the process. I'm jazzed about some of the ideas I've come up with to make it a very successful venture. And I'm looking forward to trying them and sharing with you the successes and the failures so that you can see what might work for you in your own personal stuff. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about today is price banding. We've used the concept of price banding in the past, right? I think it may have been last week's show, and I know I've mentioned it in tons of shows over the years, where you look at a graph of home prices over X amount of time, you know, how much a home sells for, and you're looking at that price, say prices on the X-axis, and then you look for number of sales on the other axis, right? Over a certain amount of time, say it's a 30-day time frame or a 60-day or a 90-day time frame, or maybe longer, where you're looking for trends that can benefit you in anything. It could, whether you're buying or selling, price banding is useful information for you. So let's talk for a second about just the general concept. The general concept is you're looking for the hills and the valleys. But one of the more important things to understand is sample size, right? Because if you just choose a month, there may be hills and valleys simply because not a whole lot of homes sold in that period of time in the area you're searching. And what you're seeing is simply the fact that homes sold. So if you see tons of homes that sold in the $500,000 range, an additional piece of information you need to know is, well, how many $500,000 homes were on the market versus other price points, right? If you had a pretty well evenly spread out number of homes at different price points, then you're good, right? Because then you're actually seeing a real bump in the market. And that will tell you things like where people have the most money to spend, what most people are qualified for that are searching in that marketplace. So you can't really drill it down to a neighborhood because there's simply not enough volume. So typically you want to go city level, unless you have a really packed part of town, or maybe, like, for instance, in San Jose, I think doing this for the entire city of San Jose would make no sense at all, because you'd be covering such disparate neighborhoods that it almost becomes not helpful. But you've got to understand, knowing your data and knowing what you're really looking at is really, really important for you to extract any actually useful information. And you can use this idea for anything. I mean, I most commonly use it for home sales activity at different price points to try to give me information on, if you're selling your home, one of the most valuable pieces of information is knowing whether or not you've just priced your home at a point that is just outside of a high activity range. Now, sometimes you'll find no banding at all. Sometimes you'll go and you'll look at the data and you can't find a place where you see a dramatic change in how homes sell. Now, another thing that you want to build into this is plotting out at what price points homes go for below or above asking price. So you could say, you could plot on a graph right next to each other, asking price and sales price, right? That way you can see what's the average deviation at different price points. Do homes tend to get X amount more at these various price points? Now, you as a buyer, this is a great way for you to inform yourself, or at least build a comfort level with an offer you might be wanting to make. Now, let's say you're shopping for a home in a town and you have found a home for $450,000 and you really like it and you want to see whether you should offer asking price. Now, obviously, there's other things that come into the equation that your realtor will usually want to ask questions like, are there multiple offers, that type of thing. Usually that'll be communicated, because sometimes some different rules, not necessarily rules, because there's no laws written about it, but a process that the agent will want to use to manage the fact that there are multiple offers. It can tell you how much you might want to offer over asking price if that's appropriate. So let's go back to our example of a $450,000 home in a neighborhood. Your agent runs some numbers for you and shows that for homes in that price range that have the same amenities, and by that I mean number of bedrooms and baths, basic square footage, that type of thing, you want to find out how much above asking price do those homes, or what amount do they tend to sell for? you've probably already figured that out, because as I said, when you first are looking at a home and you decide to make an offer, the first thing you should do is have your agent write a market analysis of that property as if they were going to list it for the sellers. You want to have basically the exact same report in front of you that the seller had when they decided on a sales price, because you want to figure out, did these folks underprice the house? Did they overprice the house? Does it seem to be right in the right range or not? Now, once you figure that out, use this data to see if it conforms to the norm for the marketplace in terms of square footage, bedrooms and baths, and then calculate the change, the list price versus the sales price, and see kind of percentage wise what the difference is. Now, maybe you'll get lucky. Maybe at that price point, what we're seeing is people are actually taking under asking price. So maybe if you're in a multiple offer situation, you only need to offer asking price, or maybe just a little bit under asking price. If the average below asking price amount is 5%, maybe you can get away with going 2% under asking price and still be very attractive. If it's the other way, if homes are tending to sell for 2, 3, 4, 5% over asking price, you can figure out where that puts you in terms of your offer. Are you making an offer that's right in there with the marketplace, or is it, does it end up pricing it kind of out of your range to go at the top of what the average change is for that asking price versus the sales price? So it's just a way, it's a way for you to identify trends, you know. And I don't know any other agents that kind of use the data. There is so much data out there that real estate agents can get access to and use to help you figure out your best sales strategies, your best buying strategies, and they just don't do them. And for me, price banding is a standard arrow in my quiver. I mean, it's something I use all the time to determine a smart price. So we were talking about the advantages to a buyer. Let's talk about the advantage to a seller. Now, and some price ranges are far more competitive than others, right? We talk, you know, homes are tending to go pretty fast right now. I have a stable of homes that I'm keeping an eye on, that I'm considering purchasing here in town. And the prices I'm seeing are crazy. The amount of time that it takes for these homes to get sold is ridiculously low. So competition for buyers out there is tough. So what have I done? Well, again, I've taken the advice I've given on this show before. I'm allowing myself to get homes into my search that I maybe would not consider living in as is, or don't fit my needs as is, but provide the basic foundations of me being able to make it what I want it to be, and in the process, saving some money. So let me give you an example. Well, no, that's a little off topic from price banding. But as a seller, I want to finish this example. See, I'm getting better at keeping things on target, a little less weed time. As a seller, a great thing to know is where your home's price fits in the activity level, right? So if we just look at sold homes in your price range, and then the price brackets above and below, and you can, this would be an arbitrary selection, right? You, instead of actually calculating everything at every price, you might just want to focus on homes at this specific price range. Now, right now, in my area, we're seeing slower sales of homes priced over about 1.3 million bucks. Now, this is the same price wall we had 2 years ago, which sort of dissolved for a little while. And suddenly everything in that 1 million to 2 million price range started to sell really well. And then things sort of retreated again. So what you need to figure out as a seller is, are you missing out on a opportunity to be in front of more potential buyers simply because you've overpriced your home by a very small amount, or have you underpriced it? Now, very rarely do I have a buyer who puts a minimum price on their search. So the odds of you pricing yourself too low and not getting noticed, not very high. And there's not a very high probability of that. So I don't think going the other way makes a whole lot of sense. I don't think discovering you've underpriced your home based on price banding means you should increase the price of your home. I think what that means is you potentially let things stretch out for a certain amount of time to see if you get multiple offers. Because if you're truly underpriced, the odds are you'll get a lot more attention and you'll get a lot more eyes on the property. But what it typically goes the other direction, where if you're priced too high, you don't even show up in people's searches, right? If someone does a search and they say, you know what, I'm willing to spend up to $800,000 on a home. Well, if you price your home at $801,000, you're not going to show up. If you at 849, 820, anything above that $800,000 mark, your home will not show up in their searches. Well, what if we discovered that there was a huge drop off at anything above $800,000? And that's an easy thing to see when you plot out the data. Now, the first thing to do is you do a search based on price. You do it over a certain amount of time. You see the standard statistical results, which is just a line by line readout of all the individual homes. But then what you're doing is generating reports that create the averages for everything, right? We're not, each little blip is not an individual house on that chart. It's a day. And you've got the price plotted on X, and then you've got, on Y, and then the X over time. But it's an aggregate, right? It's an average. So you're not looking at individual homes. That wouldn't really tell you anything. What you're looking is at this particular place in time, and usually I segregate it by either months or by quarters. You can even go as far as years, but I think that data is a little bit less useful. Quarters are typically as far as you want to go. In a town like Morgan Hill, I frequently use quarters, sometimes use 6 months, depending on how many homes are in the pool of data. There were times a couple of years ago where I had to go to 6 months or a year simply because there wasn't enough sales happening to be a decent statistical model, right? To have enough data to use. But let's say you've run that and you discover that there's this huge volume of sales happening at the sub 800,000. Let's say it peaks between 680 and 800, and there's just this huge peak that's easily identifiable. You've gone back and looked at the data and seen that it's not just because there were tons of homes in that price range and nothing else in any other price range. There were properties available, but and the other piece of data I like to look at is the days on market. You can do sort of price versus days on market, which is sometimes a lot better. So it's another way to band it. You can do prices and then do how many days on market. And you can pick, usually you pick days on market to be the X and the price to be Y. And you can see how these homes sold fast, right? The ones that tended to sell faster, say, were at X price. Ones that took much longer were at another price, right? It gives you an idea of the mobility of these properties. And again, if you see a spike at price ranges, there's a way to cut down the amount of time it'll take you to get that home sold. So let's go back to our example, $800,000. You definitely see there's a peak. Now, here's what you are kind of hoping is going to happen. You're hoping that you've priced your home very near one of these. Well, if you want to take advantage of banding, if there is no banding, then you just stick with your price. But if you are at a price that is benefiting from proximity to this kind of a change, just by taking, say, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 off your asking price, you expose yourself to far more buyers. Now, why is this important, particularly in today's market? Because the odds are more eyes equals more offers. That's just kind of the way it works. It's definitely a visibility game. What you're trying to do is get as many people to look at your property and decide they want to buy it. So if you price it in a way where you're doubling or tripling the number of people who are going to get exposure to your property, you've dramatically increased the number of people who are potentially going to want to make an offer. And then as a result of that, you've increased the probability that they will make an offer above your asking price. Now, here is where it gets interesting. And this has happened. This isn't me theorizing. I've used price banding in the past. And what I have found is, let's say we came up with an asking price of $815, right? In fact, I used this technique last year, and I can't remember which property I used it on. I had three different ones that kind of came close. But in any event, but it was for a far lesser amount of money. It was like we were at something just over four. We ended up pricing it under three, and it ended up, or was it just over five, and we went down to four? I can't remember what it was, but we ended up getting enough offers that it went up over our original hoped for sales price. That's what will frequently happen. You will end up getting enough people coming in and making offers that you not only get tons of offers that you likely would not have gotten if you hadn't priced it the way you did, but you end up getting as much or more than you were planning for, that you wanted to originally list it for. So in this example, you would end up getting your 815 or more, but it's been bid up by the bidding process to get to that amount. And you've gotten it faster, right? You basically looked at trends and figured out a way to make the trends work to your advantage. Now, of course, this only works when you're in close proximity to one of these banded areas. If you're hundreds of thousands of dollars away, I'm not going to suggest you drop your price by hundreds of thousands of dollars because you're not going to recoup that much. But if you're within a reasonable distance, there's a very good chance that this is something that can work for you. So yes, it doesn't apply in every case. I get folks who contact me and say, hey, Robert, you know, I've used your techniques for price banding and trying to figure out trends, and I can't find any. Well, that's right. There may not be any. In some areas, there may not be any. Now, my advice, which I mentioned earlier, is to increase your sample size. And typically what that means is increasing either the geographical area that you're doing it to, but you want to keep it at least within a reasonably similar geographic area. San Jose is a perfect example of not similar geographic areas. You have everything covering the spectrum from multi-million dollar homes to absolutely horrible neighbor. You can't do it. You have to use smaller chunks of San Jose. It's either about sample size by increasing the geographic area or by increasing your sample size by increasing the time back that you're looking. I had one listener who contacted me and he said, you know, I used 30 days. I used the town I live in and I'm just not seeing it. I asked how many homes sold in that month. 17. Okay, there's your problem. That is way too small of a sample size. In fact, in that particular case, I said, if you're seeing just 17 homes a month sell, and that's typical, you need like a year's worth of data to come close to anything that makes sense, right? So keep that in mind. Sample size is important. Sample sizes, I like to keep my sample sizes at least around 100. And then you need to look at it and see what the spread is. Are most of the homes, typically you'll see little bulges, right, of homes listed under a certain amount of money, or just because that's sort of the way the market is segmented. There's more demand in different price points, so there's going to be more homes at different price points. And another way to spot very impacted price points, because sometimes what you'll find, particularly in not new housing, is not enough people are listing homes at the most popular price bands. And that tends to be the price bands where you then see the most offers over asking price, right? It's a supply and demand thing. Just like it always comes down to supply and demand. If there's not enough of supply and there's a demand at a certain price point, prices will go up. If there's plenty of homes and there's not as much demand, prices will tend to go down. So, and it's also going to come down to, So the mode I'm in, and I think I've given a fairly decent explanation of price banding. Yeah. And I realized that I titled this, and this was another suggestion from a listener. They told me that my, the titles for my shows didn't have enough sizzle. So I went with How Price Banding Can Save Your Life. You know, do it for the children. Could have been another headline, I guess. But in any event, so I decided to give in to the baser instincts of puffing up a title of a show and went with that. I hope it worked. I hope you're listening to this because it ended up working. But in any event, right now, if we're looking at it from a buyer's perspective and me being in a pretty, and we're going to talk about the numbers here coming up in a few minutes about where the market's going. And we can talk about the reasons to be pessimistic. Maybe I'm not going to go down the pessimistic road today, although I think there's plenty of reasons to be pessimistic. If you'd like to follow some of the reasons I think you should be, that there's reason to be pessimistic, follow my Twitter feed. That's something else you can find on my website. You can head on over to soldbyrobert.com or therebelbroker.com. Both of them have links to both the Facebook and the Twitter page. Facebook, you know, that's something else. Okay, so I'm also going to be starting a newsletter that I plan on doing monthly. There's basically going to be three newsletters. There's going to be a general real estate news newsletter, which could cover anything from an interesting trend to new home tech to cool architecture. It's gonna cover just about anything about real estate. And then I'm gonna have two others: one for the San Martin market and one for the Morgan Hill market that's pretty much just going to be what's this month's stats, what's sold, what's that kind of information, and give graphs and things and show you performance, that type of thing. I'm gonna be doing those every month. I'm going to be doing the first one this weekend. Some of you are already on the list I'm using for this. I don't go out and buy lists to send people these things. Every person who has contacted me through Zillow, Trulia, or my website, or who has previously asked for market information using another service I was using, well, I've canceled that service and I'm migrating those folks over to this. I'm going to send out an initial newsletter and, you know, let everyone know that they're free to unsubscribe or whatever they want to do, but it's going to go out within the next 24 to 48 hours. And you can see if it's something you're interested in. If you'd like to sign up for it, you can head on over to soldbyrobert.com and find it there. I'm pretty sure I know I set up all the pages for you to be able to sign up for that. It's just a question of you clicking on what you want. I believe if you go to the menu bar on the right-hand side of soldbyrobert.com and scroll down, you'll find the place where you can sign up for the newsletter. All right. And there's probably going to be show information in there too, or other little extra tidbits. We'll see. I'm going to try to keep it to just one page a month, so it's not deluging everyone with all kinds of crazy stuff. But I've already got some great articles for this month's newsletter, so you can take a look at it. It doesn't cost anything, and it's a great way, I think, to get a pretty good variety of information on the wide world of real estate. All right. Where else are we? Pending home sales index increased 1.1% in March, up 11% year over year. Kind of a surprise that the pending home sales index only increased 1.1% in March as a month to month from February to March. But being up 11% year over year, that's good news. You know, that means more homes in escrow, more people have made offers that have been accepted on properties. I think that's a great thing. It's based on contract signings. Let's see, anything else sexy in this article? I thought there was one. To make it a little bit more local, the pending home sales index in the Northeast went down 1.5% for the fourth straight month to 80.2 in March, but is still 0.6% above a year ago. In the Midwest, the index declined 2.5% to 107.5 in March, but is 11.3% above March 2014. In the South, it increased 4% to an index of 126.5 in March and are 12.4% above last March. The index in the West rose 1.7% in March to 103.7 and is now 15.6% above a year ago. So pretty much across the country on year-to-year stats, pending home sales are up. If we had more inventory, these numbers would be even higher. The activity in the market is really low, primarily because of low inventory. Now, as a practical matter, I'm seeing more and more homes listed in the hottest price ranges or featured desirability ranges. Usually, I mean, 3 bedrooms, 2 bath, right? That's the staple. That's what everybody wants. And I'm seeing tons of week-to-week increases there. Plus, there's tons of new construction. Some of it's crazy. I was just touring some brand new construction right here in Morgan Hill for 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom homes with 2 and 3 baths. And the starting price was $770,000, which is ridiculous, particularly given the neighborhood that these things are in. They literally are an extension of an existing neighborhood where prices at that range just aren't warranted. So I'm not real sure how that's going to go. I'm guessing they'll sell because homes are thin on the ground. So things are just kind of going the way they're going. Mortgage applications decrease in latest weekly survey. Purchase apps up 21% year over year. These mortgage applications weekly surveys are stupid. Week to week means nothing. You should never come to any conclusions based on week-to-week variations in something. The seasonally adjusted purchase index was unchanged from 1 week earlier. The unadjusted purchase index increased 1% compared with the previous week and was 21% higher than the same week 1 year ago. So on a year-to-year comparison, that's a 21% increase in mortgage applications. The average contract interest rate for 30-year fixed rate mortgages with conforming loan balances, $417,000 or less, increased to 3.85% from 3.83%, which is very, very minor. So that's, again, that's all great news. Very stable interest rates, an increase in activity. These all, if you're just taking real estate as an isolated thing, you're not looking at the things that feed it, things are tending to go in the right direction. Let me just do all the calculated risk articles first because they're also unsexy. What was this one? All right. Zillow forecast, the Case-Shiller National House Price Index up 4.2% year over year change in March. Again, all indicators showing things are increasing. I don't necessarily think that's great, but it's, I mean, that would, those would all be things people would point to and say the real estate market is recovering, is getting more healthy, is getting stronger, that type of stuff. Construction spending decreased 0.6% in March. The U.S. Census Bureau of the Department of Commerce announced today that construction spending during March 2015 was estimated at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of $966.6 billion, 0.6% below the revised February estimate. So again, stupid number. The March figure, because it's month to month, no one cares about month to month, although it is interesting that it went down between those 2 months, because that you usually, as we get into summer, see that going up as builders build their homes for the season, for the summer season, right? Although it could also mean that that simply in the month of March, most of the expenses were incurred relating to the construction in terms of buying the materials and that types of things. And these folks have now just got them on site and they're going through it. It could be that kind of thing. The March figure is 2% above the March 2014 estimate. So from a year ago, it's a 2% boost on construction. That's the number that's actually more informative. You're seeing a 2% increase in the amount of construction. Spending on private and construction was at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of $702.4 billion, 0.3% below the revised February estimate, which again, useless number. In March, the estimated seasonally adjusted annual rate of public construction spending was 264.2 billion, 1.5% below the revised February. Okay, so that's not what I care about. Non-residential spending is 15% below the peak in 2008. Private residential spending has been moving sideways and is 48% below the bubble peak. Public construction spending is now 19% below the peak in March 2009, and about 1% above the post-recession low. Let's see. Now, let's go ahead and hit the world's hottest luxury market. This article really surprised me. This town was not even vaguely on my radar in terms, if someone came to me and said, you know, what are you thinking? Go ahead and write down 10 towns that you think will be the hottest luxury market and see if one of them ends up being the one, I would have lost because none of the sounds I wrote down would have been this one. It just kind of blows me away. The Canadian city of Toronto was the hottest luxury real estate market in 2014, bucking a slowing trend in the world's top property hubs, according to a new report from Christie's International Real Estate. This is an article that comes to us from CNBC. In 2014, year-on-year luxury real estate sales slowed in the 9 of the world's top 10 property markets, which top-end international realtor Christie's ranked by sales prices, average prices per square foot, and number of luxury sales. Home priced at $1 million or more were classed as luxury. It's interesting to note the places where the sales slowed. Now, keep in mind that a huge part of why some of these places we're about to list were down were because of availability, were because inventory is low. It had nothing to do with whether or not someone wanted to buy. It had to do with whether or not someone wanted to sell. So according to this, sales slowed in all of Dubai, Hong Kong, London, Los Angeles, Miami, New York, Paris, San Francisco, and Sydney. Sales grew in Canada's commercial capital of Toronto by 37%. So I know I can't speak for London, Los Angeles, Miami, New York, Paris, Dubai, and Hong Kong, but I can speak, or Sydney, but I can't speak for San Francisco and say that primarily that's because inventory is so low. If inventory was higher in those price brackets, I think we would have seen quite a bit of sales. What's interesting is this article, unlike a lot of mainstream real estate related article, actually goes into some detail on should we worry? According to this article, several analysts have sounded the bubble alarm on the Canadian real estate market, with prices in the cities of cosmopolitan Calgary and Seaport Vancouver also high. House prices in Canada have climbed an astonishing 60% since 2000, according to the International Monetary Fund, and bubble alarms have been sounded by various analysts. This would not surprise me one bit. You know, I think a lot of folks may have left American real estate when things were going bad and gone to Canadian real estate. And it wouldn't surprise me one bit if Canadian real estate finds itself dramatically overpriced. Next on the hit parade today from the LA Times, for millennial homebuyers, only Honolulu, Hawaii is pricier than Southern California. Young homes have few affordable homes to choose from in Southern California, according to a Zillow report. Go Midwest, young home buyer. Well, you'll find far more options than in Southern California. Barely one in four homes on the market in Los Angeles, Northern counties is affordable to the typical millennial household, according to a new study from real estate website Zillow. Among the 96 largest housing markets in the U.S., only Honolulu had a lower share. All right, where's the sexy bits of this one? I saw a sexy thing. Where did it go? Zillow found that 70% of homes nationwide are affordable at the median millennial income in those respective markets. In regions such as Pittsburgh, St. Louis, and Buffalo, New York, the figure tops 80%. Closer to home, 53% of listings in the Inland Empire are affordable, twice the share in coastal Los Angeles and Orange counties. You know, and remember what they're talking about here. They're talking about the disparity between home costs and income in those areas. Well, that's a very interesting thing to discuss, right? We've discussed before that the way you solve the real estate problems of the country or to solve the employment problems of the country. What we've seen, the only real job growth we've seen have been in very low-paying jobs. I got to think that those two things are related when it comes to this data. You've got folks who aren't making as much as they used to in general, right? That's statistically just what's happening. But we've seen a recovery in prices without any real increase in income. So suddenly a lot of folks are getting priced out of being able to purchase a median priced home in the areas where they live. So how do you solve that? And again, it gets into some of the bigger questions that we try to ask sometimes in terms of, well, what does a really healthy real estate market look like? Well, a really healthy real estate market is a byproduct of other healthy things like employment, like quality jobs being available, that type of thing. And I think that this is another symptom of what we've talked about so many times on this show. Let's see. They talk about house versus commute, that kind of wonderful thing. And they're talking about competitiveness at different price points. They want to spend about $360,000 and they get outbid several times. So yeah, that's very typical. That price point up here, if there was anything at that price point here, if you're looking for a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home here in Morgan Hill, you're not going to find a single family residential home that fits that. You may find a townhouse, maybe. I haven't seen one in a long time. I think that the least expensive one I found was in Gilroy for $420,000. So prices are nuts. Now, here is something that is yet another small piece in the how to effectively sell your home pie. This one's from a site I don't often get stuff from, but I kind of have a little bot that goes out there and finds interesting real estate articles for me to review. The title of this one's from Lifehacker. .com, and it's better photos can sell your home faster for thousands of dollars more. And they basically go with sale price to list price advantage for digital SLR cameras. Now, over the years, I've had brief moments where I get particularly frustrated about property photos, and we've, you know, this is a verbal media. This is an audio medium only. So I'm not able to share with you some of the goofy photos I see of properties. So let's kind of understand the scope of things. Even now, even today, I will frequently see new listings hit the MLS with no photos, for which there's no excuse. Even the cheapest phone these days has a camera in it. I have seen one photo that's absolutely crappy, clearly taken with the worst camera someone could buy, or the worst camera built into a phone, that where they have then licked the lens before taking the photo, where there's then only one photo. You know, I've seen some horrible, horrible photo sins. And what this lays out is they take homes that didn't have a digital single lens reflex camera used to take the photos. And an SLR camera is typically considered a higher quality camera. I've got a great Nikon that I use when I'm photographing a property. Sometimes I'll use a service to photograph a property, but I've got, I had, you know, when I was in college, I took photography and I really enjoyed it. Of course, back in those days, we actually developed film and used enlargers and all that kind of wonderful stuff. Now that it's digital, it's actually far more easy to manage and get good quality. I've got all the great lenses. So I actually enjoy taking photos of the properties, because sometimes I'll get a little bit of inspiration while I'm taking photos of a property and find a great angle or a great feature that I really want to focus on. Don't get me wrong, if you use a service or your agent uses a service, you're going to get really amazing, great quality photographs. But as I've said before, I'm a little bit of a control freak. And when I see what I want it. And sometimes I don't see it until I'm in the process of shooting photos. Sometimes I'll do both. Sometimes I'll have a professional guy go out, I'll see the photos, and I'll say, wow, you know, I really wish he'd taken this shot from a different angle, or I really wish he'd done this or that. Or I'll see a professional photo shoot where they didn't turn on all the lights in the house or in the scene that they were taking a shot of, or something like that. So I'm a little bit of a control freak. But there's absolutely no excuse for any agent not having the maximum number of photos allowed. I think in my MLS system, 27 or 28 is the maximum number of photos. I don't care if it's a one bedroom studio, you're going to get 27 or 28 photos. If that means I do a close up of every faucet and every tile, that's fine. More photos is better than fewer photos. So that's number one. The biggest obstacle you have is comes far before taking photos with a digital single lens reflex SLR camera. The first barrier comes with finding an agent who's not so absolutely stupid that they don't realize that you need photos at all as soon as it goes into the MLS. And there's really no excuse. It's not like that's the way the system is designed. If when you create the listing in the multiple listing service system, you can fully populate everything, import all the photos, but it never gets committed to the MLS system to be viewed by others till you click that send button at the end. So all of it can be in there. You can't use the excuse, well, you know, I entered it and I didn't have the photos handy, and so I just had to click send. Well, don't click send till you've got the photos. The part photos play is huge. I have clients that won't even look at a listing if it doesn't have photos. See, I have a little portal that I send to my clients, and I can see when they viewed it. It'll say it's been viewed. This property has been viewed. If I see one that has no photos, with some of my clients, I can see they never even viewed it. They went to the portal to look at the listings that had just been found. But even in today's market where things are so tight, when they saw that there were no photos, they didn't even look at it. So as a realtor, what I will do is when I see that they have it, that there are no photos in one, I'll mark it and then I'll follow up with it. I have a little bin of properties that I watch. It's just called watched properties for us realtors. And when I see photos appear, or I'll create a client called Mr. Needs Photos, and I'll assign it to that contact, and I'll go to Needs Photos. And as soon as that property gets photos, I'll then go to clients who have that home showing up in their search and let them know photos have been posted. So they need to go back and look at that property. But that's something I have to do to backfill the stupidity of what some other folks do, because they don't fully follow through on getting it done right the very first time. There's no second chance at a first impression. And as soon as it appears in someone's inbox, that's the first impression you get. So if you're a seller, you make sure your agent's got plenty of photos of your property as part of the listing before it ever gets sent out to the MLS for general consumption. All right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the price benefits here. What's really interesting is for homes less than $200,000, this price advantage actually seems to be a negative number, and I have no idea why. For $200,000 to $299,000, the price advantage appears to be $3,500, $3,500 an additional that on average those homes tend to get. For homes priced between $300,000 and $400,000, the price advantage is apparently $7,500, which is pretty substantial. For homes priced between $400,000 and $499,000, homes with digital SLR photos tend to sell, you're not going to believe this, for about $11,200 more than homes that didn't have a digital SLR. What's interesting is that's the peak. And from here, it starts to go down. From the $500 to $699 range, the difference is about $8,200 more for your home. From the $700,000 to $999,000 range is about $7,800. And then greater than $1 million, again, it shows a negative number, which looks like it'd be about a negative $500, which makes no sense. In my business, for homes over $1 million, not only do they expect photos, they expect top quality photos. If you've got a home for over $1 million, usually when I've got the listing, I'm actually held back by the system. 28 photos isn't enough. And I create a site. Whenever I create a listing, it gets its own site on a tool that I use called Resio, where I get all the photos. It creates a cool online flyer. I've tried a lot of different online ways to market properties. I've created their own websites. I've done all these things. I'll usually get them their own URL if they're over $1 million. But I have found that for homes at this price range, you not just need photos, you need video. And you often want a drone flyby of the property, showing everything it has to offer in an awesome aerial view. Now, these are things I've done before for homes priced at that price point. And obviously, I don't have statistics on how much of an advantage it gave. But the idea that these statistics indicate no advantage and seem to indicate a less than good advantage, a bad advantage, that doesn't fly for me. All photos are always better. So the fact that they've shown under 200,000 over $1 million is not getting a benefit, kind of mind boggling. Brokerage firm Redfin Corp looked at listings to compare those with professional photos versus amateur ones. It found that for homes listed between 200,000 and $1 million, photos taken with a DSLR sold for $3,400 to $11,200 more relative to their list prices. They were also more likely to sell within 6 months, up to 3 weeks faster than the listings with amateur photos. That within 6 months number means nothing. What matters is what was the average days on market for each one of those properties in each one of their marketplaces, and what was their deviation from that average days on market. Who knows? Maybe in some marketplaces, homes, the average home or the average sales time, the average days on market is 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. Well, within 6 months, I can't think of a property I've looked at here in a while. There's a couple, of course, but predominantly anything that's been on the market 6 months is got huge other problems. The analysis was done in 2013. It repeats a previous study the company had done in 2010 with similar results. Here's an interesting Q&A from the LA Times. Can a landlord require tenant to pay rent in cash? The answer is yes and no. The example given here is there was a question that was sent into the paper. And the question was, I moved into a small rental property 6 years ago. 3 months ago, this property was sold to a new owner. The new landlord wants me to start paying my rent in cash. I am uncomfortable about possibly not getting credit for the payment. I don't understand his motive since I have never had a problem paying my rent. Do I have to comply with this request? Now, keep in mind that this answer is California specific. It may or may not apply to your area, although it's a very reasonable law here in California, unlike many others that we all have to deal with, particularly for home folks who rent out property. As long as your rent is current, there are civil codes that prevent your landlord from requiring that you pay your rent in cash. I don't understand why someone would want you to pay cash. But if you as a renter had a check bounce, or the tenant put a stop, or you put a top stop payment on a money order or some other method of payment. In those cases, someone who is a landlord can request that you do cash payments, but you have to notify the tenant in writing, and explaining why you need it in cash and giving them a copy of the payment method you used before that was canceled or failed or bounced or whatever, you know. So, and that's absolutely reasonable. One limitation to this in California is you can only require cash payments for 3 months. And if the cash payments are made, on time for 3 months, you're supposed to go back to offering, other, methods for them to pay. Let's see. And of course, anytime that you pay cash for anything, anything, particularly rent, you get a receipt. If you go to your landlord and you go to give them cash and they won't give you a receipt, or they say, I'll get one, I'll mail you a receipt. No, you have to have something right then and there. And that can be as simple as you whipping out a piece of paper, writing down the date, the time, your name, how much you paid, and the name of the person you handed it to and why you handed it to them. And then make sure to note the amount and then have both parties sign it and you're done. It shouldn't be a problem. I always like to encourage folks to make sure that they're doing that kind of thing. You know, landlords, I think, have a, you know, a kind of a unique responsibility. And I'm trying to give this guy a back door. I'm trying to figure out why you'd want cash. The only thing I can, and none of the reasons I can think of as in terms of why he wants cash, speak well of him. Typically someone wants cash because, well, you know, and then who am I to judge how this person wants to get paid? But if they want to get paid in cash, frequently that's something that indicates that they don't want to, have the transfer of the funds documented in a easily traceable way. It may just be that this is the type of person who doesn't believe in banks and they love shoving their money into a mattress. Given the way things are today, that may turn out to be a lot smarter than the alternatives. I can't figure out a reason why they would want to do that. It seems to me they could just as easily get a check from you, go to your bank, cash it, and walk out with cash that way. So I'm not real sure what the landlord concern there is. But just another little tidbit of information for y'all, if you find yourself in a similar situation. Now, whether you've not, you find yourself in California or not, I think these rules in general are going to be mirrored pretty much across the country in some way or another. There may be some state where it's absolutely reasonable for your landlord to ask for cash, but even in those circumstances, getting a receipt is absolutely required. And I can't imagine a state where they would not require that a landlord provide you with one if you ask for it. So, there may be other, if you can think of another reason why a landlord would reasonably want to be paid exclusively in cash, you know, in my business of real estate, whenever someone wants me to pay them in cash, there always seems to be this, I don't want the tax man to find the money kind of thing. So, and I'm not interested in playing along with that. So typically it's something you're going to want to, be a little wary of. If your landlord's asking you to pay only in cash, you know, you might want to find out why that is. But again, just get yourself a receipt. Make sure you're protected. There's no reason for you to bear the burden of this, regardless of how the landlord wants to get paid. All right, folks. That is about it. I appreciate you taking the time to visit and hear what I have to say on these subjects. I hope it is as helpful for you to hear me say it as it is for me to say it out loud myself. If you'd like to get in contact with me, there's a variety of ways to do that. You can find my website at www.therebelbroker.com, and there's a little link there for you to click to contact me. Or you can head on over to soldbyrobert.com, same little link there to send me messages. In fact, I think both links go to the exact same page. So there you go. I hope you have a great week. I'm very excited about giving you a special show on Thursday or Friday this week relating to the investment purchase that I just signed off on yesterday. Once the money's in the bank, We'll chat about the process and what the next steps will be relating to that property. So I'm excited. I'll talk to y'all next time. Have a good week.